Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Apropos of Something, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio. I always like to say Persistence Radio. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we have a bonus snapshot appearance with visiting artist Todd Webb from Virginia Beach, and then we'll move to our featured interviews with Warren Craighead and Larisha Hawkins. They are both return guests. Warren draws extensively, poignantly, and joyfully. He's an artist. He draws on the topics he's passionate about. Now he's published his second volume of daily grotesque portraits of Donald Trump entitled Trump, Trump, Modern Day Presidential. And we welcome back Larisha Hawkins. She is the subject of a new film, Same God, which follows her journey from tenured professor at Wheaton College to her ouster for wearing hijab in his solidarity with Muslims. We'll discuss the film and her activism. And my friend Nancy Lawrence, are you there with me?
I'm here. I'm attentively listening. I was thinking when you were describing the daily portraits that Warren draws of Trump, and you put in the word grotesque, I was thinking, well, that's just redundant, Ellen. Of course, if there are portraits of this man, they are grotesque.
Anyway, exactly. Something that he can address when we speak to him.
What an excellent point. What an excellent point.
No, you go ahead. I was just going to say, was there enough news for you this week?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, how many? There aren't enough pockets of adversaries, I predict, that this man is in the pocket of. And by this man, I mean that grotesque portrait of which we will chat about later.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was just... And honestly, I thought, I should not be surprised that throwing tear gas at immigrants trying to get to America, seeking asylum, that didn't survive. That headline has been surpassed by Russia.
Yes.
By Trump.
You were going to say something before. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, today, the world is bigger than this guy. Today, December 1st, is World AIDS Day, and 35 million people, over 35 million people, have died of AIDS-related illnesses, and over 36 million live with HIV today. However, 1 in 7 people are unaware they have it. So everyone should get tested at least once. 6% of the people who have it don't have access to treatment, which is why I'm mentioning it, because, of course, we always need to raise awareness that it's still ongoing.
Yes, thank you for that. And also to raise awareness of something going on next Saturday, December 8th, Vibrate Higher is a book drive in memory of Heather Heyer for adult and juvenile inmates at Trinity Episcopal Church. They're going to, again, raise awareness about inmates who need books, and they're going to raise or collect books, I should say. And they're saying, while we may not be able to free their bodies, let's attempt to help free their minds. It sounds like a really cool thing.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, I wonder, I hope that 40 blue seats in the House will help criminal
maybe.
Justice reform as well.
And maybe 41. They may redo a vote in North Carolina. You've probably heard about
cool.
that. Cool. Yeah, yeah.
I'm all for more furniture reparations. Yes. Good.
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So I think I'd like to get right to the show because we have it chock full. We have an excellent show today, Nancy, as I always say, but it's always true. Our first ever bonus snapshot. We welcome artist Todd Webb.
Chockful. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Todd Webb is here. He's from Virginia Beach, visiting Charlottesville. He was here for a show last night at Telegraph Art and Comics. It was called Picture Show, and let's get a little peek into his world of comics. Welcome to the show, Todd.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about your show. Tell us about your art. What should we know about you?
I have no idea. I do.
Wait a minute. We just promised it was chock full. Come on.
All right.
Do it.
I draw comic books, lots of stuff for all ages audiences, kids and adults. I play music as well, and I do pop culture artwork for a gallery out in Los Angeles called Gallery 1988. And the show at Telegraph that's going on is a collection of just under 400, I think, different prints of drawings that I've done over the past couple of years. Some personal works and some drawings of movie characters, TV, book covers, record covers, the whole spread of that stuff.
How does your music, or does it, does only because you mentioned record covers, how does your music run into, you know, your art, if it does?
Yeah, they overlap. When I'm drawing the record covers, it's usually stuff that I listen to, so that makes it fun for me. So doing drawings of, you know, Galaxy 500 and Young Marvel Giants and that kind of stuff. Weird.
Are those bands we should know about?
Oh, yeah, everybody should know about them.
Okay.
Yeah, they're from back in the day, but they're wonderful.
How would you describe your work? I don't really follow much of this type of work, but I follow Warren, and I saw, there a little bit of a camaraderie there in the way that you guys illustrate?
We have a lot of overlap. Warren actually drew the cover for my last record.
Nice.
Which is my favorite record cover of any of my my albums.
And he's not just saying that because he's sitting right here.
No. Yeah. But we actually have ran in the same cartoon circles for years, and we didn't cross paths personally until, what, maybe like 10 years ago or something like that?
Yeah.
And that was through like Facebook or something. Like, they recommended me to him. And I said, oh, I know that guy. And then we, through talking, we found out that we'd been at the same art expos and stuff over mm-hmm. over numerous years. So, yeah, it's fun to get to hang out in person now.
Have you been drawing all your young life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say since I could hold a crayon, and lots of my artwork that I do is in ink and crayon, so I still work with them, and I do crayon portraits of people that come to my musical events and comic book shows and art openings for a dollar. I draw portraits in crayon for a dollar.
Oh, nice. So did you always start out drawing this style, and then who influenced you the most?
Yeah, I guess over time my style's gotten more and more simplified, stripped back. I used to do really heavy cross-hatching and all that kind of stuff, but simplicity over time has just kind of taken over. But I love artists, you know, like David Hockney is like a favorite of mine, and Henry Matisse, and from the comic book world, there's a guy named John Porcellino, who still does a book called King Cat Comics and Stories. He's a big influence on me.
You mentioned, I think, over or at least 400 of your illustrations, of your drawings, are there at Telegraph. Did you choose that? How did those 400 wind up on the?
Yeah, I just sent them a selection of stuff that I had available. It's crazy that over time all of that stuff is piled up, so that's really just like an excerpt of what I have available, but I tried to give them as diverse a spread as possible, so it's a little bit of everything.
How was the opening?
That was really good. It was fun. Full house. They did the grand illumination last night, too, so there's extra foot traffic, which is nice.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if you mentioned, maybe you, when, do you know when, I'm sure you do, when, how long is the show up?
It's up for the whole month of December.
Gotcha.
So where can people find your work? Because they want to see it. So what are your handles?
My website is toddbot.com, T-O-D-D-B-O-T. And my social media is toddbot.com, spelled out, so T-O-D-D-B-O-T. dotcom.
Yes. Well, you're a very, just upon meeting you, you seem like a very, you know, maybe you're introverted, mild-mannered, but the work is really, it's a little, I don't know if it's different than your persona, but I would recommend looking at it because it is really cool.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It's fun to make.
I wonder if all artists are a little bit introverted, would you say?
It's possible, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm labeling you.
Ellen.
I'm labeling you. Okay, I didn't mean to. Well, thank you for being here.
Yeah.
And I'm
going to
go check it out.
Congratulations on your show.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Obviously.
Telegraph.
I don't mind saying the obvious, by the way, Todd, in case
you're
aware. Yeah.
Telegraph Art and Comics. Go there.
Yes.
All right. There's a lot of cool stuff there.
Yeah. And now his wingman, I don't know, you tell me, does he have his head set on, or is he live drawing you? I remember this from one of his many visits. Oh, there he is.
I have been live drawing her.
He's here. Have you?
I've live drawing her and Todd.
Make it more.
And I'll do Larissa when she's on later on.
That's great. So. Make it more flattering than last time. I looked like a little, I don't know.
The problem is I draw Trump so much, I'm ruined. I can't, draw nice things now.
Oh, now I know why. I won't take it personally.
Yeah.
So let me introduce you, Warren. Let me give you your proper introduction. So Warren is a friend of the show. He's been here before. He is an artist, as you know, creating very compelling comics and drawings that deftly combine whimsy and stark reality, humor and politics. He's exhibited his work internationally and was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. He draws extensively on the topics he's passionate about, from documenting the Armenian genocide to calling out misogynists in his Lady Hater series. And he does playful drawings of his two young daughters. Now he's published his second volume of daily grotesque portraits of Donald Trump, entitled Trump, Modern Day Presidential. So welcome back. I'll welcome
you
again. Yes.
Thanks.
So tell us, for people who don't know, how this journey also started.
Well, the Trump stuff started. I started drawing him every day when he accepted the Republican nomination for president in July of 2016. I had been doing some projects, like you mentioned, Lady Haters, another one called USA Haters, where I draw un-American public figures. Un-American to me probably means a different thing than it does to people on the right. To me, un-American people are racists and misogynists and homophobes and people who hate the poor. So I call them out in those drawings. But with Trump, I started drawing him every day, and I thought, oh, I'll just have to draw this until November. No big deal. And then he didn't lose. I don't want to say he won. He just didn't lose.
Yeah, good point.
And so I swore to keep going and drawing him. And over time, the drawings have gotten more detailed, more full of anger. You mentioned earlier the people who got tear gassed at the border last week for 3 days. I drew Trump way in the background, and the foreground were the poor migrants, the asylum seekers running from the tear gas with their kids and stuff. So sometimes I try to focus on more and more on the victims of the policies of this administration than just Trump. He's kind of easy because he's so horrible on almost every level. and so I think sometimes I want to also focus on the people who are getting hurt. Like, for instance, in August, for a week, I drew portraits of all of the kids or not all the kids, some of the kids were in cages, you know, that were separated from their parents. I found photos of the actual kids, and I drew them to say, these are real people. It's hard to look away sometimes, it's hard not to look away sometimes, but we have to look at this stuff. But mostly I just draw these horrible, grotesque portraits of a melting monster that's our president.
I noticed on, I must be your website, that, because I had missed this, during the midterms, you also promised that, you know, that people could, the politicians, you know what, Warren, I know you know best how you did this, but for the midterms, you were drawing other Republican candidates. Please describe what that was and how that went.
Yeah, so I wanted to do something to help with the midterm elections. And, you know, there's a lot of things to do, but I one of the things I did was I put a call out. I said, anyone in the country, I will draw the Republican candidate running in any office, from dog catcher to senator. I guess there wasn't anything higher than that this time, or governor. I will draw your Republican, a horrible picture of your candidate, and I will, as long as you promise to put them up. And so I have people from New York, from Florida, from Texas ask me to draw their people, and then I drew them. I made a poster out of it. I made them several variations of posters. Most of the time I did things like, say, one of them was John Faso in New York 19, who lost, probably because of the poster I drew about him, probably. No, it's probably because of the hard work that people did there in that district. But I put Faso equals Trump, you know, and I did that for a lot of people. Because I think sometimes, you know, even in talking a place like Charlottesville, where people are maybe more aware because of the things that have happened here in the past couple of years, even here, people don't pay attention to these lower races. And lower, I mean like a congressional race. People didn't know that Riggleman equals Trump, which he does. He equals a lot of things, Bigfoot, love, whatever. So I did that for a bunch of races across the country. I got to draw Ted Cruz again, who is one of the easiest people to draw a horrible portrait of.
Why is that?
You could draw the nicest picture of him, and he already looks, he just has a horrible look. I mean, I hate to be superficial like that, but his inside is definitely on his outside in a lot of ways.
So
it was great because a bunch of people, you know, used these pictures. I don't know how wide they got, but it was more like I just wanted to feel like I was doing something in addition to the normal things, which, you know, calling and the sort of normal things. I wanted to use my my superpower for good, my horrible superpower of drawing grotesque portraits.
So I noticed that there was a poster outside Trump in New York City. There's a photo of that. Can you describe the way that you came about that and your habit of doing that?
Yeah. So in March of last year, my family, we were up in New York for a funeral of a family member, and we stayed at a hotel in Midtown, and the kids went to sleep and my wife was doing some work, and I thought, oh, I'm going to go for a walk. And then I was like, I'm only like 10 blocks from Trump Tower. So I walked over. This is bad. I'm saying this on the radio. I walked over and there it was. And I had these stickers and I was leaving Trump stickers. And I walked at the entrance. And this is like maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. There was a SWAT team there. You know, they're guarding Trump Tower. I think Melania and them were there. But I walk up and I'm this middle-aged white guy in, you know, jeans, and, you know, I look like a tourist, and I'm looking up. I know that in New York, I used to live there. Yeah. If you walk around looking up, you look like a tourist. So I started looking
Ellen,
up.
Ellen, did I not tell you exactly that? I'm interrupting.
I had my phone. I had my phone to my ear, and I was fake talking my phone, like, oh my God, it's so John here, you know. Meanwhile, in my hand, I had these stickers that had already peeled off, and so I'm leaving all these stickers on the side of Trump Tower, right next to the SWAT team, and they didn't know at all because I was using. You know, in a really dumb way, but I was using white privilege to completely like be invisible to them. You know, I think if I had been a person of color, I think if I had been someone obviously Muslim, I think if I had been someone else, they wouldn't have, they would have been watching me much more carefully. So, you know, it didn't really do much except vandalize a little bit, but I think the statute of limitations may have run out on putting stickers on the buildings. So.
And you don't know what it's done. Maybe people walking by have really gotten inspired by that.
I hope so. It had the website for the site on it. And I just, you know, like a lot of people, he makes me so mad. I just want to do something. Mm-hmm. I just want to do something. So,
you know, I totally agree that your white privilege allowed you to do that. And if that's one way to use it, I mean, we should all use it for good. So that is, you know, until hopefully it doesn't have its, you know, such power. But the fact that you could do that, because I'm sure, like I said, because you're white, that's amazing, and a guy, you know, that's amazing, and it's great subterfuge.
Yeah, I mean, it also, I was like looking like a tourist, and
yeah,
it was like,
sure, yeah.
But yeah,
the flash mob, your solo flash mob, in there, you know. With the...
So I hate to interrupt.
Sorry, but
we have to go. Yeah, we just need to go a break. We'll be right back with Warren. So stay with us, and shortly after that, Larisha Hawkins, professor and activist. We will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Warren Craighead. He's an artist and activist, I would say. So you wanted to mention something to us.
Yeah. So as you know, I've been involved with Second Street Gallery for a long time. And tonight they have a party. It's called the Little White Party. It's for AIDS awareness. You mentioned earlier this World AIDS Day. And so this is a big party where people celebrate. Sometimes they're HIV positive. Sometimes they're getting tested. It's a great party at Second Street Gallery downtown here in Charlottesville. So I just wanted to, I just thought of it when you mentioned World AIDS Day. I wanted to push that.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks. Today's December. December 1st.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah. Yes, Warren. About your Volume 2, does it have a certain span of time as Volume 1 did, or what is the nature of Volume 2? What's encapsulated in this horror?
Right. So the first volume of books was 6 months. It was from when he got the nomination until till his inauguration. The second volume is from his inauguration day until 6 months in. So basically a year after he got the Republican, from his inauguration until July of 2017. So it was the first 6 months of the Trump administration, or the Trump regime, I should say, actually being in power. And so the pictures get a lot more detailed, some characters who have sort of faded out a little bit, Steve Bannon, Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, are figured prominently in it. Of course, old favorites like Mitch McConnell and others are still in it. I don't know if you remember, but it's funny going back and looking at those. There was a huge push to destroy Obamacare at that time. And so I do draw a lot about that, and they failed. I draw a lot about that. I draw a lot about the travel ban that they tried to push from Muslim-majority countries that, again, they also failed at the time, but they've been more successful since then. And it's been the drawings just got a lot more angry because it was real. The title, Modern Day Presidential, the subtitle, I took from one of his tweets. He said, I know I don't act presidential. I act modern day presidential. And so I took that for the title of the book.
Yeah. I look forward to volume whatever, however many months it is now, that you're going to call it, hopefully you'll call it Very Legal, Very Cool.
Yeah, is that volume what he said?
Whatever.
Perfect. Well,
how about individual number one?
Yeah, actually, that's a good
so
one, individual
many.
Number
Warren,
one.
Leave and get going.
Yeah. I have today's drawn already. I haven't put it up yet, but you can see, you can follow them for free at trumptrump.biz or trumptrump.tumblr.com, and every day I put them up. There's also a newsletter that you can join, and I'll never spam you with anything else. I'll never sell your names or anything like that, or your list, your email address. And every day you'll get one in the mail. And those, you also get secret little notes where I'll say, oh, I drew this way because of this, or this person in the background is this. I just want it to be spread as widely as possible. I've drawn him almost 1,000 times now. So I've probably drawn him more than anyone else has ever drawn him, which is a horrible award to have, I guess. But
well, you have Obamacare if you need to seek some sort of medical.
Yeah. No, I'm lucky that I have good health care, right, if I can't need mental health services.
Yeah.
I did have a professor. So where I work, a professor came to me. She said, I'm worried about you, drawing this every day. And I said, well, it's great because I can actually do something. Like I'm not just like seething. And of course, there's a lot of things to do, a lot of ways to be active and resist. But this is one way that I do it. So, it doesn't bother me at all. I don't mind. It's fun drawing him.
I would have to say that you are just as mentally sound as you were the last time, if not better. So I think
which
it's
is not much.
Which I think it is working. And that's a good point about expressing and getting it out and being active really helps. However, it is. I mean, there's so many ways. Who would think, you know, to maybe a person who's not an artist, they wouldn't think that that is a way to do something. But whatever it is, I think, like I always say, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. So just find that thing. And we're still in the thick of this, and I think we're going to be in the thick of it for a while.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Has drawing him gotten, has it gotten, actually, I'm curious, has it gotten harder to do? Is it more, has anything changed in your sitting down to draw this, whatever he's up to lately?
No, I mean, some days it's hard to choose from all the different things, and then some days, I have to figure out exactly how to illustrate it without, I mean, I try not to fall into the same trap of the sort of traditional editorial cartooning where, oh, there's a bag of money with a dollar sign on it and it's running away. You know, I try not to do that. I think of myself as an artist first. And so I want to really make these compelling sort of drawings. But it hasn't been hard. He does so many horrible things. I can just go to his Twitter feed and find horrible things. And then there's all the people in his administration. I have a few that are in my back pocket right now, stuff that people have done that I'm ready to go with. So, so keep watching, keep looking, because every day there's another one.
And how do people, is it at W Craighead that we find you and sign up?
Yeah, you can go to craighead.com, which is my art website. You can also go to trumptrump.tumblr.com or trumptrump.biz and sign up there. And you can, yeah, either of those places you can sign up for the newsletter or just follow along.
So, you have mentioned a couple times on my volume 2 there are more of his, of his administration, of his regime in under your pencil, under your sketch. And so have any of them risen to the same level as of, cravenous corruption, cruelty, as you draw, or is he still the king of all?
Well, I think he's the symptom, not the actual problem, in a way. But I think one prominent character in this second book is Mitch McConnell, because he was pushing the destruction of Obamacare so hard. So I draw him as this horrible turtle monster, chewing on people and eating them. I mean, there's some real, I was really looking at Goya and some other very horrifying pictures to draw from. So Mitch McConnell stands out in this volume. Steve Bannon marches around with some big jack boots on, which is, seems pretty appropriate. For a while, Sean Spicer, because he would just get so mad, and it was so fun to draw him at the beginning. Yeah, there's a lot of the cast of characters has expanded, and so there's more storylines to follow in the second volume.
How about Stephen Miller?
Stephen Miller, you're right. Stephen Miller shows up. In fact, in the second book, he shows up because he went on like Meet the Press or something and completely defended Trump in this horrifying way. And so that's when I really started drawing Stephen Miller, and Stephen Miller's still there. Sebastian Gorka was there for a little while, but Stephen Miller has hung on. He's still around, and he's, I'm sure, super happy with everything that's gone on with demonizing people trying to come to our country for asylum.
Well, it's not Trump's idea. I mean, I'm sure it's Stephen.
No, there are no ideas in there except money.
Right.
So
money, greed, sex.
Yeah.
Do you ever fantasize about, do you allow yourself, what will be my last drawing of this? How will this end? Or anyway, do you
well,
ever
the way it was,
go to
the he was supposed to lose, and so the way it was supposed to end was he melted down into this puddle of goo, and then after the election, all these animals were going to come in and just eat the goo, and he would just disappear. But, of course, he didn't lose. So I don't know what will happen. I mean, I think part of it depends on how it goes down. I mean,
I understand. Yeah.
He's eating so much McDonald's and stuff. I wonder if it's just going to explode at some point or have some kind of, horrible health problem or... if something, if he just resigns, I don't know what he's going to do, but I don't really have a plan in place.
I think that you should get color into your, think about color in your palette so that you can draw a lot of orange, or maybe we could just manifest that that happens.
I did a cover for a Swedish art magazine where I colored one of them, and yeah, I used this bright orange.
But I mean for his jumpsuit as well as his hair.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, it'll match his skin. It'll be like a full body, like...
Yeah. You should put your next, don't you love it when people tell you what you want?
I love it. No, I need ideas. I draw him every day. I need all the ideas I can get.
But this one's a good one. Put all of your next volume 3, whatever, put them all in a tanning bed and take a photo in there and then, you know.
That's a good idea. I could do that for these. That's for a promotional photo.
Exactly. I'm looking out for that side. I wouldn't give you creative ideas.
Well, Volume 3 is going to encompass what happened here in Charlottesville last August, or the August before last. And I already have a subtitle for that, which is Blood and Soil, which I think is appropriate. So,
Yes, that's why you're in charge. That does sound very noble. Yeah.
I also have a Mitch McConnell idea. I mean, unless you've already done this, the fact that he's the one stopping the bill to protect Mueller to go through.
No, I haven't gotten there yet. I do draw the witch hunt stuff a lot. And sometimes in the drawings over the horizon, you'll see a little Bob Mueller with a little butterfly net watching. Bob Mueller, he's got his own issues in the past, but I think that he's definitely seems to be doing a very professional job in this. So it's good. He seems to do a nice two-step this week on Trump. So
yeah.
Do you have any other? I know you do. So, what in the short time that's left, what other projects do you want to tell us about that you work on?
I'm doing a lot of sort of other daily projects. There's one where I'm drawing the World War I 100 years later. Of course, that just finished, but I'm still drawing some aftermath of that. I'm drawing every day. I draw a drawing about the Armenian Genocide, which was happening 100 years ago. That's kind of cooling off now as World War I ended 100 years ago. And then I do projects like I mentioned earlier, Lady Haters, USA Haters. It's funny that all this political, social work, I also do a lot of work that's sort of just poetry comics and sort of more artsy based as well. There's a whole side of my work, and that's what I was kind of doing all the time until a couple of years ago. So basically, like Todd said, or Todd was telling a kid last night at the opening, just draw all the time. I just draw all the time. And I think that's probably where Todd and I really connect the most, is that we just draw all the time. So,
and your kids get to watch what's happening to Dad's style.
Oh yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I draw the kids too. I draw a weekly strip about the kids and the crazy things they do called fauves. So
what
all
is,
of that.
Yeah. What is a fauve?
Well, fauve means wild beast in French, but it was the name of a group of painters that were just before the Cubists. Of Matisse or early Georges Braque. And so they used very keyed up, bright colors. So I thought, well, my children are wild beasts, and I color them with these bright colors, so it fits. And it's French, and France is awesome. So
yes, and they are really great. They're really bright and so adorable and cute.
Yeah, they're a good antidote to Trump.
Yes, exactly. Let's end on that.
Great.
Well, thanks for being here, Warren.
Thanks, you guys.
Congratulations on the second. In a backhanded sort of way.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on again.
Yes, so. Do you need to mention Retro, whoever?
Oh, yeah. So the book is out by Retrofit Comics. Yeah. On my website, there's a page about the book. You can see sample pages from the book. You can pre-order the book. The book's going to be out, and I'll do a signing here in Charlottesville, and it should be out any day now, but you can pre-order it already. And like I said, go sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss any of the horrifying drawings. You can have them right on your phone.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Yes.
Yep.
Nancy, do you have a news note for us?
I do. It's horrifying on its own.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry, but I want to say this one because too many of these have happened and I don't. So very briefly, although I apologize, on Thanksgiving, the next unwarranted death of a 21-year-old named E.J. Bradford is the latest man murdered by a cop because he was black. The cop arriving, this is at a mall in Alabama, the cop arriving at an active crime scene saw him, who's actually working at the mall, and is a soldier But regardless of any of that, they saw him. He was trying to help people get away from the fight that was happening. But he had a weapon because he had a legal permit, a license, whatever the proper wording is, to carry a firearm. But regardless, he was there trying to help people get away, steering them away from that scene. But the police person, I'm not even sure if it was a man or a woman, the cop saw him, shot him in the face, killed him. This lethal mistake lasted long enough that the police actually praised this cop for killing, called it heroic for killing the wrong man. The shooter actually got away, so far as I know, anyway. They gave Bradford no warning. He was given no medical assistance while he was on the ground. Again, so much for, you know, they always say the good guy. We want the good guy with the gun. And other people, apparently in Alabama, you can carry a concealed weapon. So other people had guns, you know, when the shots rang out. But this mm-hmm. was the guy, you know, moving towards the scene to help. But the good black guy with a gun is not allowed in, once again.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It seems like it is happening every day. I mean, I know that we should bring the statistics on the air. Well, thanks for bringing that to our attention.
I know, it's a horrible segue.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It relates, you know, it all relates. So I want to welcome Larisha, and then we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be back with her. But Larisha is also a friend of the show. She's a professor in the Departments of Politics and Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. She's the subject of a new film, Same God, which follows her journey from tenured professor at Wheaton College, a Christian school outside of Chicago, to her ouster for wearing a hijab in solidarity with the Muslim community in 2016, and for her Facebook post asserting that Muslims and Christians worship the same God. The film has been in festivals and diverse venues all over the country and the world, from Charlottesville, L.A., and Cork, Ireland, to the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Hawkins has spoken to diverse audiences, including the risks of this topic, the risks of public scholarship at the American Academy of Religion in Pasadena, and many, many other venues. Welcome back to the program, Larisha.
Thanks for having me back again.
So congratulations on the film, and I'm really so excited that it's getting such a great reception all over the world. And I was lucky enough to see the film in Charlottesville and see you.
We got a selfie.
You got to send me those pictures.
I will.
Okay.
I will.
And the director was there, Linda, is it Midget?
Yes.
And this was last month, and the moderator there, Curtis Schaefer, who's the chair of the Religious Studies Department at UVA, said it was the most important film on religion in America he's ever seen. So what has this experience been like for you, screening it all over the world in all kinds of venues and seeing all these different kind of audiences?
It's been obviously overwhelming and really heady in a sense. I would say things kind of come full circle in that screening in Chicago was both, you know, difficult and also it felt redeeming in a way to be with people who were colleagues that I know and I love in my adopted home city for the last 10 years, 11 years now of Chicago. And so in some ways for me, it's been personally very healing, but then also I think it came at the right time as a kind of insertion point in a moment where, you know, to segue from what we were talking about with Warren's book, I think the danger of the Trump moment, I like to call us in the midst of Trumplandia, it feels like a bizarro universe every day. And I think the danger of the moment is he threatens to dehumanize us and unmoor us from our efforts to be one. So the film for me has been a reminder of what embodied solidarity is all about, why persistence, as you were saying earlier about the goal of your show, Ellen, is more important than ever. And as Warren was talking about his kids, I look in the face of college students every day, and I'm hopeful, and I'm reminded why we can't allow this person who somehow remains a human to dehumanize us, even as we seek to resist his unjust policies at every turn. And so, you know, I don't like to go, I'm a political scientist, and funnily, I don't like to go all political, because one of the things that it does is it takes me off of the focus on what I hope embodied solidarity makes us do, which is become vulnerable.
So we're going to talk more about what embodied solidarity is, what that means to you after this break. Don't miss it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So, Larisha, you were talking about embodied solidarity. Tell us what that means.
Well, one of the things that behooved me as a professor of political science was we get to sit in classrooms all day and talk about, pontificate about what it means to do justice. Ultimately, government politics are geared towards justice in the public realm. And I became convinced that, you know, I wanted to model for my students and include as part of my pedagogy moving towards justice, whatever that looked like experientially in the classroom, outside of the classroom, internships, externships, whatever it meant. And the idea of embodied solidarity is theoretical solidarity isn't solidarity. The people that I admire most in history are folks like, you know, Dorothy Day, Jane Addams, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Gandhi, King, Mandela. Their movements were spurred by moving towards the margins where the most vulnerable people actually live. And MLK's life was changed, his whole movement was changed by spending time on the west side of Chicago, living in one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, which remains one of the poorest and most violent neighborhoods in the city. And living in West Lawndale changed his focus to the Poor People's Campaign. And both Coretta Scott King and their time there, that spurred his opposition to the Vietnam War. So you see a dramatic shift in MLK's philosophy, his thinking, the embodiment of his movement on the basis of him moving close to the most oppressed. And so I think, you know, when we hear Trump talk about the migrant caravan and the border, as a Christian, if you don't see Jesus in the faces of those babies, in the faces of those children, in the faces of the trans women marching, the first to reach the border were LGBTQ folks. If we don't see Jesus in the face of the migrant caravan, I submit we don't know Jesus. And to me, what Jesus modeled was that coming close to the oppressed and the vulnerable. And that kind of permeability of borders illustrates the kind of vulnerability we have to have towards our fellow humans. And that's what I think this Trump moment threatens to undercut in us. I don't want him reelected, but I also don't want in the end of his 4 years in office to be less human than I was than he came in. I hope that I see my neighbor more, not less, and moving closer toward my neighbor, whatever political persuasion they are, than farther from them. And it's not easy work. It's hard work. It requires a movement of our souls, because we have to see the humanity in the other. Otherwise, we're just like Trump.
Larisha, you know, given the obvious rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia and religiously motivated hate crimes, I'm not asking you to solve this. I'm just curious. What possibilities are there for some sort of multi-faith solidarity?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that this week I spoke to three classes other than my own two classes. Two in the middle of Minnesota via Skype, and one on UVA's on grounds at UVA. I almost said campus, which is a no-no. And there is hope. I mean, I see every day college students doing the hard work of coming together across their differences and discussing difficult things and living. I tell my students our classroom is a community. Entrusting difficult issues and topics to one another. I see people in communities doing that. But what I do mean, and I'm glad that you asked the question, Nancy, is I mean beyond going to synagogue once after the Tree of Life massacre. Like, people moved toward the Jewish community and began to see the anti-Semitism that was blatantly present at Charlottesville, right? This isn't a new thing. But go to, you know, black church, white church exchanges aren't going to change things, right? There are churches that do that every year, and those churches are still segregated, and those people still live in certain neighborhoods, and people still don't want their kids to go to the same school. Charlottesville, sorry, we still have segregation academies, and a lot of you listening send your kids to them. And the reality is, it takes difficult decisions, choosing to move towards community in significant ways, not in one-off ways. It's like when schools hire a chief diversity officer and don't give them any money or power. That's the equivalent of people's reconciliation efforts. And so showing up in Muslim communities, supporting Muslim communities, and I can tell you Muslim communities are doing it. It's the white Christians who aren't doing it. It's the secular progressives who aren't doing it. The first people to show up at the Tree of Life Synagogue and who are still there are the Muslim community, right? They're the ones like taking risky actions to go the other way. It's almost always the oppressed folks who are doing the moving. So, I mean, really my call to embodied solidarity is to white folks to start calling out. It's white people who need to call other white people racist. I can call white folks racist all day. There's a huge onus on majority culture right now. And folks don't want to hear that. Similarly, Christians need to call other Christians heretics in this moment of 81% of white evangelicals endorsing a person who bears no fruit of Christianity. Like, we got to call heretics heretics, people. I mean, like, I'm not God, but I think there are moments when we have to say this is idolatrous or this is heretical. The category exists for a reason, right? And so I think those are things that sound categorical and extreme. Nevertheless, sometimes you got to categorize in ways that make differences. And that's, again, that's in the effort to rehumanize, not to dehumanize, to say we can't stand for this. Like, our kids don't deserve this. My nephew doesn't. My college students, who I see as my own nieces, nephews, kids, Warren's kids, they don't deserve it. They deserve a world that's better than that. And it's this happened on our watch. Trump happened on our watch. We're not just complicit. We did it. So I'm all about taking responsibility, collective responsibility for where we are and moving forward from there.
Why do you think, why do you think white evangelicals give him such a pass on all of his, I'll use the word, unchristian behavior? Why do they support this guy?
I think it goes back to what I said, you know, kind of calling a spade a spade. I think some people who claim that label maybe haven't thought very deeply about how far down that label goes. I mean, my understanding of Christianity is that the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount says to walk a mile in our neighbor's shoes. They haven't walked a mile in the migrant caravan folks' shoes. Like I said, they don't see Jesus in the caravan. And I also think that they're willing to sacrifice the bodies of the most vulnerable on the altar of capitalism, right? White evangelical Christianity and American capitalism have become so intertwined that I think a lot of people don't know the difference. And so all of the eggs, excuse me, of white, many white evangelical churches are in the basket of the Republican Party. And they can't imagine an alternative vision. Their imaginations have been stultified in a way that they can't imagine any kind of alternative reality to the Republican Party and the kind of economic supposed advancement package that's offered by that party. And what goes along with it is a white supremacist Jesus that ensconces them at the top. It's about fear of replacement, as the white nationalist said. They don't say those mantras, but they live them. They might as well be chanting blood and soil, because that's the image that they evoke by supporting Donald Trump and the Stephen Millers and the Sebastian Gorkas, who, no, they're not in the White House anymore, but they might as well be. There aren't people in the White House wearing white cloaks and coats, but they might as well be. They might as well be. They were the ones who were marching around Thomas Jefferson's statue in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th, the 81%. That's who I see.
What you had said the revolution will not, in fact, be peer-reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I am in the academy. I love what I do. Students give me hope every day in a world that is effed up. And I study the effed upness. I study the intersection of race, religion, and politics, right? So I study that effed upness all the time. And while I love research and teaching and publication, the cutting edge of social change is at the margins, right? It's not at the heights of the ivory tower or the ebony tower. I'm a black woman, so let's call it that too. Let's be inclusive. But I think academia is part of the neoliberal hegemony that white evangelicals voted for. Academia is quite conservative in its orientation, at least from the administrative standpoint. So does academia want to take a chance on scholarship that pushes the status quo of capitalism, that dares to say that perhaps the neoliberal hegemony does not inculcate and aggregate to the common good, that perhaps pushes us towards the better angels of our nature, the kind of scholarship that says, well, the kind of scholarship that's actually predictive of revolutions, that's the stuff that didn't get published, right? Prior to the third wave of democracy happening, like, models weren't predicting that. What predicts that, the way that we learn that is by being, like, listening to the voices of the most oppressed, listening to people, and that's not what Ford Foundation grants tend to fund, right? So I love what I do, and I love the academy, but I don't see the academy as the center of the ripple effect and the murmur that we need to change humanity. And that's okay. I will still do what I do. I don't expect not to be kicked out of the academy in some other way, because I think the vision of the academy is quite small. I think some schools are making spaces and places, and I will give a nod to UVA for creating the Religion and Democracy, Race and Democracy Lab, in response to Charlottesville. Dean Ian Bockham, the Religious Studies Department, the Politics Department, and a lot of other departments are coming together to try to look at what does it look like to marshal our university resources along with communal resources and think about those alternative visions from the perch of the university. So I'm very hopeful, and I'll be working with that program. And actually, I'm teaching the first class, one of the first classes, the first introductory seminar called Religion, Race, and Democracy to first and second years. So they're working on podcasts to kind of dream about what it looks like to reimagine Monticello, right? To reimagine what if Thomas Jefferson had listened to Edward Coles, who actually freed his slaves, a contemporary of Jefferson. And so that's the kind of dreaming my students are doing, and that's exciting. But that's not pervasive throughout the academy. And UVA is one of the most elite institutions in the world. So this project does give me hope, but sometimes these projects are short-lived, and we'll see how long it goes. I hope it goes long. You know, my tenure here is kind of linked to that right now. But I'm also pragmatic, and I know that people get tired of this kind of stuff. But it's the kind of stuff we have to do. And this is why I'm excited that we have that I get to be on with artists today, because I think what art does is push that envelope from outside of institutions. There's a lot of inertia in big institutions. So the artists are also propelling us forward. So
the film that documents the time that you were at Wheaton, mm-hmm. Which is almost 3 years ago. I know it was December 10th. I've learned that was the anniversary coming up. You are touring, when you tour now, you're back in the public space about that. When you talk as you do right now, what do you get back at you, either questions or comments? And that's probably too general, but you please be specific.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the most interesting questions I get are people just want to know how to move forward in positive ways, which is encouraging to me, right? Some of them still kind of want to know, like, well, have you forgiven Wheaton? What's that relationship like, et cetera, et cetera. No, they haven't asked to screen the film. We've offered so far no takers. But one of the things that I feel is most important is that, like I said earlier, it's an insertion point for people to have hopeful conversation about what it looks like to move forward, right? And to that extent, it's been a really, like I said, I can't say anything other than overwhelmingly positive experience for me. It's been tiring. Like, I'm going to Michigan after I teach a class on Tuesday to screen at Calvin College, which is in Grand Rapids. It's a Christian college, not unlike Wheaton. And so there are exciting opportunities to raise these kinds of questions that we've been talking about, because people are asking similar yet different things. And when I was in Ireland, one of the best questions I've ever gotten was, do you think the response would have been the same in Europe if it had happened there as in the U.S.? And I said, you know, Europe likes to think it's different and better, but it's not. You've got hijab and burkini bans, and, you know, it's a different political context. But the same wave of anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist sentiment is sweeping the entire Western world. So this is not just a U.S. moment. It's a world moment that we need to continue to press through.
Thank you so much. We could talk to you all day, but we unfortunately need to leave. So thanks for being here, Larisha Hawkins, Dr. Larisha Hawkins. You can find her at Same God Film or at Larisha Hawkins. See the film now. And thank you, Warren, and thank you, Todd. And thank you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Thanks, y'all.
All right. Let's play it out. This music is by Springtide.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Showing hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.